Hey there,
Glenn
John.
Lowry.
Hey, John.
How are you doing?
Doing well. Welcome to the Glenn Show. Welcome back, John. It's been a while, I think.
Thanks for having me. It's been quite an end of semester and beginning of year, but good to be back. How are you?
Doing all right. As you say, end of year, start of a new year. We're on break, of course, we academics. I've been out to San Diego to the annual meetings of the American Economics Association, made a presentation there, which was okay. And visiting some family and trying to gather my thoughts for the new term when I'll have to teach two, count them, two PhD-level courses to our students at Brown.
Two at a time.
Yeah, I've got to teach two in the same semester, exactly. You know, pretty much two-thirds of my annual teaching is going to be crowded into this, and since it's PhD students, they actually couldn't expect me to know what I'm talking about.
You have to do something, yeah.
I may have to prepare before I go into the classroom.
It's interesting, because I won't. I'm actually looking forward to a semester coming up where both of the classes are ones I've done before and recently, and so I'm looking forward to seeing how they'll be different from before. But for my Western Civ class and my class on language in America from, you know, the dawn of time until now, I've done them before, and so I'll actually get to breathe and finish up the book that actually I'm writing. So I'm going to have an easier time over the next 5 months than you, I get the feeling.
Tell us about the book, John. I just wish I could get myself going on something, and I'm laggardly. So inspire me with an account of your productivity.
Well, you know, my new book is going to be, I think it's going to be called See What You Want to See. And what it's about is this idea that you see in the media, and it's always very popular, that the language that you speak is a pair of glasses on the world. Depending on how your language works structurally, you see the color blue more vividly, or you're more sensitive to the shape of things than other people, because some languages will have explicit marking of those kinds of things more than others. For example, if you have a language where things have genders, like in Spanish, el sombrero, a masculine hat, la luna, a feminine moon, it's said that you therefore perceive things as gendered in a way that you and I don't, because we speak English. And I frankly think that that theory does not hold up in any way that would have any meaning to us as we live our lives, but it becomes more popular every year. There have been some very good books about it that, good as they are, nevertheless leave thinking people thinking that if you speak language X, you see the world in a different way than if you speak language Y. And it just isn't true, I think. And so I'm writing a book, a kind of a punchy little manifesto, where I try to explain why that isn't true and why really what languages show us is that all of us, whether we are tribes people or whether we are first world people in therapy, are seeing the world in the same way. And I've been working on that. To be honest, Glenn, I don't know when I have fit it in. I started it in August when I was already complaining about how busy I was, and now I'm down to the last chapter. And I think I'll have it done by the time the buds are on the trees, and I'll just that's the one that I'm finishing right now.
Consider me inspired.
Well, you just have to take your Fridays. That's what I do. Just sit down, and somehow it happens.
You have to not be lazy. I think this may be my problem.
No, it's not lazy. It's that I have a disease, which is that I feel like I don't belong on the earth unless I've got some project going. I mean, I practically get physically sick, and so I just have to have something. And next thing you know, you've got a book on. You are probably more content with the world than I am. That's probably it.
I feel sorry. If it's true, John, I'm sorry for you, my man. But let me ask you this. I mean, I know nothing about linguistics, which will become obvious momentarily. But I did read Steven Pinker's great book from years ago, The Language Instinct.
Yep,
and
classic.
I remember learning there about Chomsky's universal grammar and about the kind of deep unity of all human language behavior in, you know, sort of bio-neurologic foundations and all this kind of stuff. And that would lead me to think that the hypothesis that you're critiquing in this book, if you've described it, would be dubious from the very start. While these languages have different particular rules and conventions and so forth, there's at a deeper level some kind of universal connectivity between all these languages such that it, which is rooted in the structure of the brain itself, such that it wouldn't be possible for people to look at the world differently simply because they use different, you know, particular conventions to express this linguistic universalism. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah, you're definitely correct. And Steven Pinker's been a very articulate proponent of exactly the view that I'm trying to put in here. He has good chapters in that book and also in The Blank Slate that really take apart this whole idea of languages being pairs of glasses. But they're only single chapters in his books, which are magnificently cornucopial about other things. And so I think the public never quite gets the message. But yes, language is, to some extent, and it's very controversial exactly how, and I personally don't believe that Professor Chomsky has hit upon it, although that's extremely controversial, law language is at heart the same. And then there is the question as to whether the ways that they're different make us different people. And what a lot of it is based on is an understandable desire for educated Westerners to show that we understand that people who don't have the quote-unquote civilization level that we have are equal to us mentally. That's where a lot of the appeal of the idea comes. And so you say, oh, look, you live in huts by the river, but you perceive the shape of things more vividly than we do. You are uniquely adapted to your environment. And all that's good, but there are other ways of respecting people who are different than us. And I think it's all very fascinating. The book is actually more positive than it sounds, but something needs to be said in a single book that explains this. And yeah, a lot of people are going to get mad at me. Psychologists are going to tell me that I don't know enough about psychology to fully understand. But you know what? You don't have to. And I've actually enjoyed reading a lot of the experiments, and they're good in their way. But I don't agree with them. It's kind of like some work in economics that I'm sure you have similar feelings about.
Yeah. Sounds good, John. Sounds very good. Down to the last chapter. That's extremely impressive, John. The book will be out in the fall then, huh?
Yeah. So what happened at these conferences that you were at?
Well, I was at the Allied Social Science Association meetings, which is a group of professional organizations, the largest of which is the American Economics Association. But it also includes things like, you know, financial economics and agricultural economics, and the black economists have our or their, I'm not quite sure which, own group called the National Economics Association. And their labor economists have their own. So these are the economists, academics, business economists, you know, and financial economists and so on, who get together to have their once a year thing. And, you know, many hundreds of papers are presented and many scores of sessions stretched out over 3 days. The meetings were in San Diego this year. A delightful place, I must tell
you. That's a wonderful conference town. Yeah, I have fond memories.
Hotel strung on the waterfront there, and, you know, nice restaurants. And
I know just the hotel you mean. Yep.
Temperate climate and all this kind of stuff. It was bearable. I tell you, it was bearable.
Glenn, I hate to ask. What's, and this is a genuine question, what is black economics? What's the agenda there? I mean, I have no idea.
The idea of black economics would be controversial even amongst the Association of Black Economists.
Of course.
That is, that there is an economics peculiar to black people or different in some way because of racial identity. I think most thinking people would reject most
disagree.
African-American economists. And African economists would disagree with that. However, they might say that at, I think, two levels. One is, you know, sort of networking and, you know, making it in the profession, and there are very few blacks, and so we ought to hang together and help each other and, you know, share information with the younger generations and so forth. So there's a kind of, I don't know what, protective or, you know, professional clique or network.
Sure.
Built around racial identity because, you know, there was a time, you know, before the early 70s when basically there were no blacks and
very little
discussion of black issues at the annual meeting. So one thing is professional networking. The other thing, though, I think is the agenda that the set of questions that are of interest to African Americans, whether they have to do with domestic social policy issues, poverty, welfare, crime punishment, this kind, discrimination, and so on, or they have to do with a more global vision, you know, development on the continent of Africa and this kind of thing, there are a different set of questions that would be important to people given our interest as African Americans that need to be promoted and, you know, organized around and such like that. So that's that's the rationale I think that people would give. The Black Economist group began as something called the Caucus of Black Economists in the late 1960s during the height of the, well, you know what, the 1960s.
The riots and, right, yeah.
and all of that. And we're kind of petitioning for recognition, the larger American Economics Association. You know, give us a session at the annual meetings where people can come and discuss in their papers the things that we're interested in. You know, invest resources in encouraging young people to come into the economics profession, young people of color, through something like the American Economics Association Summer Program for Minority Students, which continues to operate in the summers with undergraduates, encouraging them and training them so that they'll be prepared to get PhDs in economics and life matters. So, you know, that's how it began.
I had never
40
had
years
never
on. And no reason why you should have in particular, and, you know, with credit to my colleagues, I'm actually not an official member of the National Economics Association, but I am an economist, and I'm Black. So, and at this particular meeting, a gentleman who died a couple of years ago, a very distinguished economist named Marcus Alexis, who was a professor at Northwestern University, who was chairman of the not the ICC, not the Interstate Commerce Commission. Well, maybe it was the ICC. That old government entity that used to regulate railroads and trucking across state lines. And I can't remember that, but he was chairman of a gate, and then he was a governor, he was a president or something of the Chicago Federal Reserve Board. So he was a distinguished economist, many years a professor at Northwestern, and he passed away 2 years ago, and he had been a founder in the late 60s and early 70s of the National Economics Association and the Caucus of Black Economists. And so he was being remembered. I had actually been close to him early in my own career. Even as an undergraduate, I was a student at Northwestern when he was on the faculty there, and he advised me. And then I came back as his colleague. My first teaching job was at Northwestern. So, you know, there was a reason to be amongst the Black economists this time around, since my dear old friend and mentor was being his life and work was being celebrated.
But, right. Do you get any flack by any chance? And this is I'm just wondering. You know, because you're a public person, for one thing, and you've got some views that some people consider controversial, although I would imagine that within economics, in terms of the mainstream, there's more of a rightward tilt, so you get in less trouble. But among the Black economists, I'd imagine that some people would have a real problem with some of the stuff that they see you saying, for example, on Blogging Heads, or even that you've said in your books. Or am I just kind of making this up?
John, you're spot on. John, trouble is putting it very mildly. There are people who don't speak to me even to this day. I'm telling you, and this is not about me. This is not about me, and I want everybody to know I'm fine. I'm okay. You know, my feelings aren't hurt. I'm not nursing any grudge or anything like that. But, I mean, there are people I've known for 40 years who would barely look me in the eye because I used to be a Black conservative.
Of course, yeah.
I have been a Black conservative since 1995 when I resigned from the American Enterprise Institute thing about whatever, whatever. I mean, used to be a Black conservative, 25 and 30. They can't get over the fact that Glenn Lowry was a neocon, that I published articles and commentary criticizing civil rights leaders and so forth. And so there are people to this day, who have a hard time meeting my eye and will not say hello, and I've known them for 40 years.
You know, that is, I thought so. And I have a little bit of that. It's interesting. There's a, and it's the little things. You know, there are some who will not talk to me, or, you know, only in the most polite way. Or there's a book out right now that's about how Barack Obama talks. And, you know, it's a rather interesting book, and it's about how he has used his, you know, Black inflected speech style to get a message across and what it means. And, you know, I'll openly admit that I kind of checked something. I must have been sent that book by about four different people. And so finally I took a look, and I am mentioned exactly one time, very much in passing, and at one point they even have a list of all the scholars who have endeavored to show the world that Black English is legitimate speech. And they list various people who, you know, really, some of them have only made two presentations, you know, just little, tiny contributions. Some of them are very famous. But, you know, to be perfectly honest, I've been at the forefront of that. I would argue that in terms of convincing the not already convinced that Black English makes sense, I am actually pretty good at it, and I've done it in many very prominent places, all of which is to say, I'm not on the list. And the reason is not because they don't know who I am. It's because they figure that it would be wrong to even print my name. They think of me as Satan. And that's just the way it's always going to be. And I just wondered if it was the same way among the economists who were people of color with certain commitments. I see that it is. But, you know, c'est la vie.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's complicated, I think. We're talking about, like, being an outcast here. And in a way, you know, we're not really, you and I, outcasts. And in a way, and I'm sure you would agree with this, we don't have anything to complain about. I mean, we're both doing just fine, thank you.
Yeah.
We are broadly appreciated for our skills and, you know, gifts such as they are. And the fact that there is a clique somewhere of a kind of ingrown, you know, sort of ethnically self-absorbed, almost, you know, neo-separatist, almost in a way, kind of, you know, we're going to go over here and do our own thing, and we're not going to let McWhorter or Lowry in because they don't play nice, you know. They go over there with the white people, and they tell the white people what the white people want to hear. I mean, that's a minor distraction. At the end of the day.
Of course.
Not anything that anybody's going to lose any sleep over.
No, you and I would both rather be ourselves, definitely. Although, I must admit, I am very sparing these days as to putting myself bodily in those situations, just because life is short. I'm busy trying to be happy. And, you know, and it's not that anybody attacks you. Most people are not, you know, that confrontational. But it's just, you know, the things that are not said and... You know, you're trying to have conversations with people, and it's clear there's some shoe that hasn't dropped. I used to engage that sort of thing more 10 years ago than I do now. But no, ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, those are cliques of people. And I think that ultimately, if anybody has won, if we're going to put it that way, I think you won and I won in that more people are listening to us of all colors. But still, you can't help noticing things like that sometimes.
I'm grimacing over here. You can't see it, John. But the reason I am, and I don't disagree with anything you just said, you're right. But the reason I grimace is I'm thinking about, you know, there was a time when really good people who were African-American and who worked in my field anyway, I don't know if in yours, didn't get the recognition that they deserved. I mean, there was a time when they couldn't get appointed at leading universities. They had.
And you mean after 40 years ago?
No, well... I think it continued. I mean, I don't think it ended all at once. I think it gradually. I mean, I would have said 40 years ago, people who were working on certain issues affecting African-American economic development, let's say in cities and stuff like that, were thought of as second tier people. People who worked on women's issues or Black issues in terms of discrimination and occupational segregation. That was not the top drawer kind of topic, and they might not have gotten the recognition. People who were at obscure places, they might have gotten a PhD in the days of segregation at Ivy League University or something, but ended up, because of discrimination, at a second-tier place, might not have gotten invited to conferences or had their work supported by foundation or things like that. And stuff. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, so there was that time of segregation and relative exclusion. And then the doors began to open up. And some people, because of opportunity and fortuitous circumstance and their own talent in their industry, rushed through and got accepted within the mainstream. I mean, just to point to my own case, I was a tenured professor at Harvard University in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in 1982, that was a pretty early time in the history of these things, and certainly in economics, to have achieved that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I was at the top of my class, again, with modesty, at MIT. That was practically unprecedented, okay? So now, what do the rest of the African-Americans do when these doors are opening up and some in their number are rushing through, breaking through, breaking mm-hmm. free,
mm-hmm.
breaking ranks, breaking mm-hmm. ranks, and others are perhaps feeling neglected and left behind. You know, I could have done as well if I had had this or if I had that. You know, they're just giving him a lot of attention because he's the favorite chosen house mm-hmm. Negro of the establishment. And, you know,
oh, yeah.
their noses are pressed against the candy store window. There may be some feelings of jealousy. There may be some feelings of resentment. And if the person then takes an intellectual or political position that's at odds with what's the consensus amongst the group, mm-hmm. you know, that person might end up being ostracized or persona non grata, perhaps shouldn't come as any surprise. And I say all of that not to excuse this behavior, but perhaps to try to better understand why people had a hard time. And, you know, I don't know about you, John, but I was a pretty arrogant SOB when I was 35 years old.
Right.
I thought I knew everything, and I knew a fair amount. and when these mediocre and second-rate, these words should be in inverted commas, people mm-hmm. writing in journals that nobody reads
mm-hmm.
and having their own little special black session at the meetings when I'm invited to the regular sessions to present my work, you know, I didn't have any time for them. And so mm-hmm. they haven't forgotten that.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's in my neck of the woods in terms of the black linguist, to the extent that I have any reception outside of where they spend most of their time. I don't think they've noticed. They don't care. It's not what they're interested in. I know I've never been resented because of that. I feel kind of bad sometimes, and only in a very passing, visceral way, in that in terms of people being promoted because of times changing, I offended in two ways back in the early 90s. Because I actually, and I openly admit this, I got a job at Cornell that I most certainly didn't deserve. I was hideously undercooked when I got my PhD. I kind of studied what I wanted to. I wrote a very narrow dissertation. I did it easily because I'm good at that kind of thing, but I was very green, and I have self-educated myself into being normal since, but I did not deserve that job. And there are people to this day who I'm sure have seen me on TV or, you know, this blogging heads or read some of my books and said, you know, who's he to talk about the pitfalls of affirmative action? Because I remember the year he spent at Cornell and he wasn't making any, you know, great argument for black intellect. I had no business. And those people are exactly right. I've changed since then. But the fact of the matter is, one, I think I disappointed some people in that I was promoted much too quickly because basically I talk a good game and because I was the right color. Then on the other hand, I think that a lot of the people in that black world you're talking about thought of me as the bright young black light who was going to get out there and preach the proper message. And nobody thinks of that consciously. It's just, it's unthinkable that you would get out there and say some of the things that I've said and to right. mean it and to say it again and to say it in big venues. And so a lot of those people, I'm sure, have shaken their head and thought, oh, I wrote letters for him. I promoted him. I had them at this conference. I thought he was going to be, you know, proper person. And then he turns out to be this apostate. And I can put myself in their heads and see what that looks like. And, you know, I kind of like the way I've gone, but I do kind of feel like in becoming myself, in being me, and that's all that we can be, I ended up rubbing a lot of people the wrong way. Some of them, the white ones, thinking he's not as competent as he should be, and I'm hoping nobody has thought that since about 1998. But then also, even up to last week, I'm sure there are people thinking, boy, we wouldn't have given him that fellowship, or we wouldn't have had him come speak. If we had known he was such a pig. And, you know, you just have to basically live with that forever.
Yeah. You know, listening to you puts me in mind of the great and recently deceased economist and political scientist Albert Hirschman. I wonder if you ever saw his book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty.
Complete blank, no. No.
Well, it was published in 1970, if I'm not mm-hmm. mistaken, 42 years ago, and it would still repay a close reading, I think, mm-hmm. John. Hirschman, who was a professor at Harvard for many years and then at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, where he was the sort of reigning economist and social scientist for decades, Hirschman argues in that book about how it is that organizations do or do not successfully meet challenges and reform themselves. Companies that are losing their markets, governments that are corrupt or dysfunctional, families or, you know, clans that are off the rails in one way or another and need to be reformed. And his point is that, you know, insiders, people who are members of these groups or organizations, have a choice about whether or not, in their dissatisfaction, as they recognize that reform is necessary, to exit, to leave, to vote with their feet, to get out, or to exercise voice, which is to say to critique, to argue, to disagree, to become a dissident, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's this tension between these two options that the individual has, the individual within the group who perceives the need for reform perhaps earlier than others do, and who can either get out and make his or her way elsewhere, or can stick it out and fight for what they believe is right. Now, because they are early in this process of recognizing the need for reform, most of the members of the group are going to resist what they say.
Of course.
It's going to punish them, going to question their loyalty. The book is called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty.
I must read this.
Hirschman's, one of his deep insights, I think, is that there's loyalty and there's loyalty, okay? Mm-hmm. Blind loyalty is not loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just going along blindly, my country right or wrong, as they march off to war or persecute the minority group or revile the memory of their forebears by instituting rules and laws that are contrary to, you know, the principles of the nation or whatever it might be, blind loyalty, that's not loyalty. The willingness to endure persecution, ostracism, you know, mindless rejection in order to affirm what you believe, that's true loyalty. Okay. So, and Albert Hirschman just died a few weeks ago, and he should be remembered, and this work is important in my view, so I commend it to your attention.
This sounds like it would be a nice compliment to Eric Hoffer's book, True Believer, because
Which I don't know.
Yeah, that one would be a useful one because it taught me, and I suspect that the book you just mentioned, which I am going to read, would reinforce this, is that it is so fundamental to human nature to have a sense of belonging, to have a sense of fellowship, to have a group. And it's highly unusual, it's highly marked for somebody to actually want to be an individual. And it's one thing to want to be kind of different in a recreational way for a bit of time, but to really step away and not have a sense of belonging to anything is not natural to our species in terms of psychology, in terms of sociology. And that's why people will march off to war to avenge hurts done to their forebears, why movements tend to not have the most coherent of motivations or narratives. And that's what this sounds like. If you are somebody who really does step outside and say, this isn't right, and I'm not even going to pretend to think so, and I don't care if you don't like me and you say mean things about me. That, frankly, is, and I'm not saying this in a cute way, that is evidence of a profound peculiarity in an individual. You and I, in that sense, are both troubled people. I truly believe that. And I'm not going to make some noble speech about how it's the troubled people that move civilization ahead, because just as often, troubled people do really terrible things, as we've seen recently. But I think of being somebody who steps outside, as opposed to that other kind of loyalist you talk about, who stays inside and fights from within, but everybody still likes them and nothing really changes. The ones who really step outside, I'm sure that we'll find that there's something genetic about it. And it moves me. Because we're always going to be human, and yet change is needed in so many ways. Wouldn't you agree, though, that to step outside and to really be the apostate, and for not to be about religion, but about just the way you make sense of things, is a troublesome thing? You're odd if you do that. You're likely to be somebody who's in analysis, etc. Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, it makes so much sense, John, that it reminds me of the time I first went into analysis.
I regretted that when I said it.
Back in the late 1980s when I was going through a personal crisis in my life and a lot of stuff was coming to a head, and I went into this shrink. He's a good guy, you know. He was a really good guy, and he helped me save my life, actually. And we're talking, and I'm complaining, you know, and I'm going down the list of ostracisms, and, you know, they didn't do this, and they did that, and you believe this, and you believe that, and you believe this, and I had like 8 of them. And at the end of it, he said, did you ever stop to think why it is that you always find yourself in that kind of a situation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was a light went on because I realized it was true. There was something about my makeup, my constitution, my personality, my character that constantly led me to the margin of whatever the activity was, okay? Mm-hmm. It constantly led me to be a person kind of with one foot in and one foot out, or a person who, when everybody else was nodding, that was the signal for me to start thinking more deeply about what was being affirmed.
To not be a joiner. Exactly. You are not a joiner. Yeah. And that's your essence, to look at everybody else nodding and think there must be something wrong with it. And there's a part of me that's that way too. That's a very odd way to be.
John, there's people out there who are gonna listen to this, you know, and they're gonna say that's just a high level of intellectual obfuscation of the fact that these guys are assholes.
Yeah, they're gonna say that, but you know, in that case, they're wrong. You know, that's a view that's understandable, but it probably comes from somebody who naturally is a joiner. But it'd be very hard to imagine being in the brain of somebody, not who's brilliant, has nothing to do with brilliance, just somebody who doesn't have that natural sense of seeking the warmth of crowds. And that's why I say it's probably partly genetic. And if you don't, it leads you to think funny. I'm sure that there's a spectrum of Asperger's about it. That's just a wild guess. But yeah, and there are those sorts of people. You can see them in various fields, and I think they create as much trouble as they do progress. And to have progress, you also need to have the joiners all together doing things. It's just the way humanity works. But it can be kind of scary to contemplate it. But Hirschman, Albert Hirschman?
That's right.
Right? Albert Hirschman, and the book is called what?
Exit, Voice, and Loyalty.
Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. Okay, I'm going to go grab that today before I go home.
Excellent. Good. I think I've done a day's work if I got you to read Hirschman, John.
Oh, I'm really going to read it, too. We should talk about it next time. That sounds very interesting. Was it a big classic in its time?
It had a huge impact. I love the book for a number of reasons, both for its substantive argument, but also because it illustrated a kind of intellectual activity that is almost lost now to economists, certainly, and I don't see much of it anywhere else, which is that, you know, I mean, he's not, like, overburdened with a lot of number or calculation or formalism. He's thinking. He's thinking. Mm-hmm. Okay? It has a philosophical air to it. It's got an awareness of institutions, politics, history. It's filled with examples, including examples from literature. Mm-hmm. It is deeply thoughtful, creative, original. It's analytical. But it's not pedantic. He's not counting angels on the head of a pen. Everybody can get access to the argument. You know, it's just the kind of writing I think of the great Nobel economist Thomas Schelling, still living, thankfully, as another example of this type of, you know, he writes essays.
Who you're breaking up a little bit? Who's this other person?
This other person is Thomas Schelling.
Okay.
Who is a Nobel Prize winner and he's the author. I guess his most famous book is called The Strategy of Conflict, which was about games of confrontation and violence between nations, analyzing Cold War type strategic interactions between the East and the West, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, in terms of the new science of game theory, which Jonathan Neumann and Oscar Morgenstern had introduced in the late 1940s. But Schelling, very creative, and he went on to work on many other kinds of issues, including climate change, racial segregation, the problem of self-command. This is Thomas Schelling I'm talking about now. Mm-hmm. But I mention him only to underscore that this generation of economists, you know, born early in the 20th century, educated in the years of the Depression and the Second World War, Hirschman is a European, spoke 8 languages or so fluently, fought in the French resistance against the Nazis valiantly, heroically, and had to run from the Nazis and came to the United States and then built this great career here. But they were real towering intellectuals. They weren't technicians. You know what I mean? They read history, they read politics, they read philosophy, they thought about ethics. And when they came to economics problems, they brought all of that, the grandeur and the kind of, you know, depth of that intellectuality to their parsing of the everyday problems of economic analysis. And it showed, and it's very, very hard to find these days.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Interesting. You know, talk about the contrariness. I almost detect an implication in what you're saying, that there's no one today who does the same thing. It seems like so often today when we see an academic writing in that vein, we call them facile. I wonder if the art really has been lost, or whether it's just there's a little bit of jealousy in some of us to see someone doing it. For example, would you have the same estimation of someone writing on that level over the past 5 years? An economist or a political scientist? See how tough that is?
It's hard. I mean, I can think of living people. Amartya Sen is one who's still, you know, very much with us and very active and thoughtful. And I'm sure I'm doing a disservice by not mentioning somebody whom I should be mentioning, but it's hard to think of who these people might be, you know, 60 or younger, who are
considered shallow popularizers who just like to hear themselves write. Yeah.
Right. It's hard to... Well, specialization. I mean, one of the things that's happened, of course, you know, disciplines change, and they mature, and as they mature, they may get a little fractured and specialized, and you know, people branch off into this or that, and you can say that's a sign of progress, right? That's the indication of the maturation of the science, that it can be reduced to, you know, as Thomas Kuhn, the historian of science, put it, you know, the normal science activities of puzzle solving within a framework that's already been elaborated and shown to be robust. So then the activities become much more technical and much more small bore. And I expect that's part of it. But some of it, I think, is just the loss of a certain kind of learning, John. People just haven't read the books. You know, they just haven't, thought about certain things. They don't need to think about them anymore, they think. And in that, I believe they're wrong.
I don't know. I know what you mean. I have a visceral temptation towards it, but if you look at the bestseller lists of 100, 90, 80, 70 years ago, they look exactly like today's. I don't think that there was ever a reading public that was more up on psychology, mythology, history, foreign languages, etc., than the one of today. And I think that just as today there are books that are often bought but never read all the way through, for example, pretty much any book that's getting a whole lot of press that's nonfiction and 700 pages, almost nobody's actually reading it to talk about. That was as true 70 and 80 years ago as now. You can find it out when you read about the people who wrote those books and the sorts of comments they encountered about them. So I'm not sure, and I really don't know, but I know that even in linguistics, we academic linguists will look at somebody who has a popular work, and it's, you know, almost a sport to say, well, he got this wrong, well, he got that wrong, he's just trying to be famous, I'm sure it's been done to me. And the fact of the matter is that in 50 years, I'll bet a lot of those books, and I don't mean mine, will be looked back on as these classics that attempted to get to the common human being. And I just sometimes wish that we weren't as dismissive about our present, and by we I mean me as well as other people. But it's a tough problem. I wonder if Hirschman got barbs at the time for dumbing it down as opposed to being erudite yet accessible.
We could go find the reviews. I'll bet you he did. I bet you you're right. And what you say is a useful qualification, or maybe even refutation of the position I just took. Because as you were talking, I thought about Daron Acemoglu. Okay, so this is the economist at MIT whose book with James Robinson, Why Nations Fail, was just published. It's a big, rambling, ambitious, technical in parts, but not overly so, and not inappropriately so, grappling with an attempt to explain why some nations are growing and rich and others are floundering and poor, and what role that institutions, you know, of the enforcement of contract and property and maintenance of civil order. And
somebody writes that book every 10 years. That's right. Yeah, and they have something new, right?
These are like, if you will, and I mean this with great respect, the Steven Pinkers of economics, if you like. You know, I mean, they're taking on a big problem. They've got a very broad palette, you know, very rich in terms of the sources of information that they draw on. Historical, political, quantitative analysis, qualitative, and so forth. I don't think they do many interviews but themselves, but they might cite people who have reported on interviewing decision makers and such. And they're dealing with an extremely important problem. You know, and I think about Joseph Stiglitz. Another example. Here's a technical economist, a Nobel laureate, a very widely influential technical economist who has now set for himself, you know, the broadest of sort of problem agendas of, you know, his last book, The Price of Inequality. He's written about globalization. He wrote about, you know, the transformation of Eastern Europe after the fall of communism.
No one discounts him.
And there's really no one quite like Joe Stiglitz, and he is an exemplar of this intellectual style that I'm referring to, even though he was also a master of the more technical economics. So, you know, you're right. I'm probably being too quick and too dismissive about the current scene.
So. Well, you know, before we finish, I want to ask you a quick question that's a preview of something I'm sure we'll do a Blogging Heads about.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask it real quick and dirty. Would you think it was a good thing if the Supreme Court outlawed racial preferences as we knew them, which is what it seems like they're likely about to do? Good or bad? I am waiting at the edge of my seat for them to go with Abigail Fisher in her suit against the University of Texas and have the regime that we've talked about and both experienced be rejected as obsolete. Not as having been originally wrong, but as obsolete. I want it to happen. My feelings about it are not nuanced. How do you feel?
No, I don't want it to happen, John, and we really should discuss this.
Really?
I don't want it to happen. Here's my concern, all right? It's not about preserving the particular regime of preferential admissions to colleges, which is the subject of Abigail Fisher's lawsuit. I don't think the world comes to an end if the number of African Americans at elite and highly selective universities, which is not most universities, were to go from being 6% or so, which is what it is now, to being 3% or so, 2%, which is what might happen if you got rid of all preferential affirmative action. First of all, the Supreme Court's decision would only apply to public universities, as I understand.
That is true.
So there would still be affirmative action at the Browns, Princetons, and so on. I don't think the world would come to an end. But my concern is that the rationale for instituting this kind of policy was an affirmative acceptance of public obligation to redress the historical inheritance of racial inequality. Okay? It was a legitimate item of public business to say
it was, yes,
that
it was.
This should be something we're trying to do. And then the question would become, by what means?
And how long?
And how long? Well, how long could be how long it takes? I mean, you know, anyway.
But the question then is, what it? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, by what means? What it? So now Abigail Fisher's suit comes out of Texas because the University of Texas, in addition to its 10% plan, admitting students in the top 10% of their graduating class, regardless of their SAT scores, into the flagship universities of the state system, was not producing enough racial diversity, and so they started using quota or separate admission standard on top of that.
Again, right.
They went back to that, and Abigail Fisher is suing because not that she's challenging the 10% plan.
No.
But the 10% plan was explicitly introduced in order to pursue the goal of bringing more black and Latino students into the university. Now, here's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of the baby going out with the bathwater. That's a bad metaphor. I'm afraid of finding it in the age of Obama unnecessary and not worth public attention to redress racial inequality as such, as racial inequality. We don't think race anymore. We're all colorblind now. That, I think, would be a mistake. If they said, go back to 10% and other such plans, you can't use preferential admissions, okay, that would not be the end of the world from my point of view. But if what I'm observing here is the historical arc bending away from a public embrace of the goal, as a legitimate goal of redressing the subordinate status of African Americans, which derives from our, you know, history of discrimination, then I think that that would be very regrettable. So that's why I say I hope that they don't decide broadly. If they were to rule narrowly, it would be one thing. If they decide broadly, I feel it might be a harbinger of what I think would be a wrong historical turn for the country.
We need to definitely readdress this one, because I am you make me feel very I don't know whether I'm ahead of the curve or behind it, maybe both, but as far as I'm concerned, definitely the 10%, although I've had occasion to talk recently to some professors at the University of Texas. There are some definite powerful arguments against some of the things that were happening in the wake of that, but in general, I think that we really should have socioeconomic preferences, and I think that those should not go away until we are pretty darn close to not having any socioeconomic differences, and therefore, forever. And I will own that statement.
Exactly, we're never
going to
be there.
Yeah, we're not going to get there. But in terms of the racial part, I feel that if we also agreed that the time to stop the preferences was not when there were no differences in racial equality, that, you know, a couple of generations have gone by, it's more trouble than it's worth, and that what we were trying to do is taken care of equally, and there are many people who've made the argument much better than I could, by having all of these programs be about addressing disadvantage in general. And I have just noticed that over the past 15 years, if you said that in 1998, many people would shake their heads, and the standard vision was, well, there are going to be all these working-class white kids coming in, and that's not what we were talking about. Nowadays, to the same people, you say, make it based on class, and they nod. Something has changed. And I think part of it is that we're realizing that the feeling people had 20 years ago that the white working-class kids didn't count was really classism of a shameless nature. And I think that we're seeing the better part of our natures in getting past that. But obviously, all of this is very complicated, and there are many ways it could go. But I want to be clear. It's not that I want to get rid of preferences. It's just that I think it should be about how you grew up. It should not just be about living while black. I don't think that's enough anymore.
Understood. So. And we should devote a conversation to this. You're making Rick Kallenberg's argument, the social.
That's who I was thinking. Yeah, exactly.
Put
Richard Kallenberg.
Idea forward a long time ago and has been reiterating it of late. So let us discuss.
Yeah, he's good at it.
Let us discuss the next
we shall.
Time we meet. Okay,
let's
John.
Do that. And so we'll talk next time, and have a good rest of the day.
We will, and thanks for joining me on The Glenn Show, John.
No problem at all. Talk to you soon.